This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Guest in studio with us
superstar,
now.
superstar.
Okay, we have Roan, also known as Tyrone Wright. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. You're in here to talk to us about a really exciting new exhibition that's going to be opening very soon. But before we get to that, we want to have a bit of build. I think most of our listeners would know who you are from your previous exhibitions, like Empire, but could you tell us a little bit about your background and how you even got into this sort of very unique field of the arts anyway?
Yeah, I guess it all started for me with moving to Melbourne from Geelong and catching the train and seeing all the street art and graffiti in the laneways, and that just inspired me, and it actually just became, I come from more of a skateboarding background, and I'd travel around the city like that. And it was a social activity that I would do as a skateboarder. And then I started to introduce painting with that. And then that became my social activity. And I started to have less friends that would skateboard and have more friends who would paint. And
yeah.
You kind of didn't, break yourself as much, and you still just had as much fun. And
yeah,
my whole kind of social world at least kind of changed around that.
But where did it start from as a painter? Because the detail is very strong. Did you go to art school or anything?
I think, I've always been drawing and painting as a kid. I did study graphic design, graphic art, but I feel it's just it's a practice thing. It's like, it's just one of those things, if you keep doing it, you're going to get better.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think I'm skilled at painting. I've just been able to continue to do it over the last 25 years, I got better at it.
Yeah. Your rise to fame has been just gigantic in the last, maybe 10 years. In your wildest dreams, did you ever think this would happen? And the fact is that it's more than just you painting on walls. It's the whole experience of when you walk into, it's going to be at the Flinders Street Station. How iconic is that? But what you create is something really special. When did all that start? And that house that you had when they were pulling everything else down, and you kept that one house there, and I queued for 2 hours to see that inside of that, which was such a treat.
Well, thank you so much for queuing for it. But that was one of the real tipping points of my work. Like, I wanted to. Even going back to the street art and graffiti thing, like, what was exciting was painting in these abandoned buildings and just doing whatever the hell you wanted in there, and you'd create this, work on the wall, and you'd take a photograph, and often it was the environment that kind of made it interesting. And then you would, as my career progresses, like, I get offered to do something in a gallery, it's like, all right, here's a bit of wall space and you can put a canvas on it. And how do you translate that into a gallery? It was, it's a real kind of tension point for street art and artists and graffiti artists trying to get into that area.
Yeah.
And it was at a point where maybe 2016, I kind of got really sick of doing these murals, and it's like, I go to a community, I paint someone from the community, they get a mural, I move on to the next community. And it wasn't so much doing work for myself, I was doing it for these other communities, which was great fun, still probably the best job I ever had.
Yeah.
But I kind of wanted to take it back to, just doing it in these abandoned spaces, more personal work, something that's a bit more emotive. And the only way I could do that was to just paint them and take photographs. And so I did that, and I kind of presented those as my artwork. And then I realized that people want to see the real ones that they can step into.
Ah, right.
And then skip ahead, I was offered a house that was about to be demolished. And I was like, oh, this is perfect. But I went into the house, and it wasn't It wasn't broken. It was just like completely just cleaned out. It was clean and there was nothing in there. And I could paint on the walls and I was like, all right, but it didn't, it had lost its soul. And that's when I spoke to my wife, Alice, and was like, oh, I kind of want to bring some furniture in here. And she's like, well, talk to our friend Carly, who's an interior stylist. And she just helped us find all this furniture and stuff. And then we realized that we could start to tell these stories and give the house, you know, character back and a soul. And it's like, it was, we started to be able to play in a whole new dimension.
Yeah.
Of art.
And even even to the extent where, you know, like there were all leaves in the corners of the room, or or you would obviously chip off part of the wall to, you know, give a feeling. And, you know, like you felt as if you were wandering through somebody's, you know, like that just stepped out of it and then you painted. But you created the whole scene per se.
Yeah, and it was, I don't know, a lot of it was like the leaves example. Like, for example, very exaggerated. Like, yeah, there might be a few leaves. We're just like, you know what? Let's just fill this room with leaves. You know, it's we have this artistic license of, you know, we can do whatever the hell we want. It's art.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool to exaggerate those things.
Yeah.
As I go along.
But what about when you went up into the Dandenongs? You know, like both Eve and myself saw that separately. What you did there was, you know, extraordinary. Explain to us. And what was the venue?
It was Burnham Beaches, which was a famed hotel in the 80s, 90s. Mm. But before that was originally the home for, is it Alfred Nicholas, who was the inventor, I think, of like Aspro.
Yep. And it was a beautiful Art Deco building.
So was it Nolan who designed it? It's an incredible, building on its own, and it kind of looked like a ship. I think that's one of the references for it. And it was this iconic building, like set in this forest, long forgotten, and no one had really used it for 25-30 years.
And big too,
and you know, like, huge. Something like I probably used about a dozen of the main rooms. But there's another 60, 70 rooms that were additional wings that were built not as the original home. But yeah, the space was gigantic and but also completely stripped of anything. So when I was offered the space, it was at like a real point where I was about to take some time off and Alice was 9 months pregnant, and then someone just puts this like ridiculously amazing, you know, canvas and opportunity on the table. And
how long did it take you?
Yeah, so I pretty much just lied to all our friends and said, oh yeah, I'm just taking time off to raise a child. But the truth was I was driving up and down the hills every day.
Wow. And the kid was born and was 12 by the time you finished.
He was walking.
He was walking.
He was walking by the time it opened.
Wow.
You're also a part of the history of that place as well, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
And I mean, one of the things about going to the Empire exhibition was it was quite haunting. There was a really great job was done of creating this story and atmosphere as you went down the hallways. And I mean, it felt like it escalated as you went through. And I remember coming to a room, which might've been the library, that was filled with water as well. And my personal background is in set dressing, production design as well. And I remember trying to ask anyone I could there, being like, how did they do this? Like, is there a false floor? Like, how deep is the water really? Is it a few centimeters? Is it a meter? Like, when you're planning something like that and you're in a heritage building, how on earth do you convince people to let you do something like that? And how do you go about planning something so involved?
I did start with heritage. And the deal I made with them was basically anything I do, I have to reverse. So I was like, okay.
Oh, wow.
Anything so that was the deal. So everything I did painted, I had to paint back over white. Right, and I was like, oh, I can do that. So except for the floor. So I had to protect the floor. So it was the one thing, is like, oh, I'm not sanding floorboards. It's too far. The library with all the books and the flooded, like perfect example of that. Like I didn't know how to do it, but I thought I knew how to do it. And so I literally put a message on my Instagram stories. I'm like, in on here, like a structural engineer. I got a random question and a few people wrote back to me. And it's like, so I've got a, you know, a first floor building. It's, you know, 300 mil concrete. How much weight can I put on that? And they're like, oh, yeah, I wouldn't put more than 300 kilos per meter. And I'm like, all right. And just literally did the math on like how much water weighs. It's a liter per 10 centimeters, you know, like, and looked at the room. It's like, oh, that's more like 30 ton. So, like, okay, cool. I can't do that. So that was when it's like, oh, but if I do a raised floor, it cuts out all the weight.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, then it only ended up being like 2 inches deep.
Right.
Yeah.
But then I had to cut all my furniture in half.
Oh, to make it look submerged.
Like it was sunk.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So wow. That was.
But also the image, you know, like that you painted there was on the spines of the books, which a lot of people that when I was looking at it and I stood there for a while and I thought, I can see something that's different with this. And then I realized it was on the spine. And I mentioned it to the friend that I was with. And then everyone else looked at it and went, oh, my God, yeah, we hadn't noticed it.
Yeah.
So some very, very clever tricks. Talk about clever tricks. What are you doing now at Flinders Street Railway Station?
Yeah, well, straight off the back of Empire, there was, you know, a lot of people came. And one of the people who came was the then planning minister, Richard Wynne, and he's like, what are you doing next? And I'm like, I don't know. I just asked him, he's like, what's happening with the Flinders Street Ballroom? And I just saw him like ticking his head, and he's like, there's actually nothing planned. And I'm like, okay. So that just like, not that he kind of opened the door for me, but it was more just like, he let me know, he's like, there's an opportunity here. It wasn't a yes, but it was definitely not a no.
Yeah.
And so I've spent the next 3 years making it a yes.
Whoa. And behind the clock as well, the famous Flinders Street clock.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's a wonder they let you in that room, and the fact that, you know, like people are going to be walking into that room now.
Yeah. Well, it's all an illusion.
Oh.
Everything's an illusion. This is what's it's been fun to play on these things. Like, yeah, I want to take people to the clock, but you have to go up 6 ladders, and we're trying to do things that are, you know, accessible to everyone. I worked out I could recreate the clock, and I could actually, I feel like, exaggerate it and make it more exciting than the actual clock room, which I've seen and which has been renovated in the last 5 years, and it's just a concrete cold room now.
Right, okay.
So, yeah, we've been able to fictionalize it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But why tell us? Why are you telling us that? Yeah, like you should have kept it a secret.
I don't like to lie about things, but it's also even knowing that it's illusion, like even I believe it. Like it's a really strong illusion.
Fantastic.
And it's the fact that you know, that it's been created is almost more interesting in itself once you do realize that.
Yeah.
That it's not just the clock. It's you know, it's an imitation of the clock, and it's like, no, it's actually a sculpture that we've created as an artwork.
Yeah.
And so on that kind of level, it therefore becomes my artwork rather than just the clock.
Yeah. Gosh. And what's the exhibition called, talking about the clock?
Time. Yeah. So, of course, you know, you always go through random names when you're trying to develop a project, and it always just came back to that time, you know, like what of, you know, everyone knows Meet Me Under the Clocks in Melbourne.
Yes,
it's just a signature of Melbourne.
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, our next guest has got this book out, and I think he's in the studio next door to us. And what is it? It's Flinders Street Station.
Yeah, that's such an icon of Melbourne. Everyone just Meet Me Under the Clocks.
And yeah.
Like, I was playing on that, but I also learnt recently that all the train drivers would set their clocks, you know, by the clock at that tower, and then go out to all the regions and update all the towns
at
the time.
Wow.
So time itself for Victoria would come from that building.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Which is a real kind of beautiful thing to think of, like resonating out into
Wow. I'm getting goosebumps. This is going to be such a great experience to go to this exhibition. Eve was, I'll pose the question to us that she wanted to ask you before the show.
Yeah, I mean, like, I have a lot of questions about this exhibition because just the fact that you've been given this incredible, mysterious space that everyone's been, like, waiting to see again for so many years and has only just opened back up, having free rein to do what you want to do. But I'm really curious as well about kind of, like, this signature style that you have of painting the portraits on the walls. What is it about, like, in particular the female portraits, what is it about those that's made you want to keep them in all of your work?
It's, I guess, yeah, it has become like a signature of my work. That it's all started from back to the street art and graffiti and putting works up in the street, and a friend of mine was putting up a screaming vampire. And basically, I just wanted to do the opposite of it. Like, I was doing a lot of, you know, masculine, aggressive stuff at the same time. And I kind of wanted to do a work next to his. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do the total opposite.
Yeah.
And I started putting up this calming beauty. And it kind of led me to this, like, as it evolved on the street, I felt it spoke louder than this screaming vampire. And then it would, you know, the poster would be torn and ripped down, and it would the beauty would still hold in there, and it actually become kind of more interesting and beautiful as it became more fragile. And it just has sent me down this path of kind of exploring that idea of, like, beauty and decay and fragility and transient, and, you know, like, even like it looks back at graffiti being temporal. And that's why I think, you know, graffiti and street art is exciting, because it is only there in that moment, and you need to document it because it might be gone tomorrow. And
yeah.
I think, yeah, that all comes back to this idea of, like, why I'm painting this muse of this beauty. And, like, there's this, you know, beauty does not last. So it's kind of appreciate it now. And, like, whether it's the beautiful Art Deco clock on the table that's, you know, there, and that's, but it, you don't get the same emotion from a clock as you do from, you know, a human. Mm. It's like, and, like, we have, you know, different parts of our brain just literally just, like, click in. As soon as you kind of bring in, like, a human aspect, it's like it becomes an emotional conduit. So putting those works there, and with the, you know, also with the sound that we're bringing into these spaces as well, it's becomes quite a powerful emotional trigger for a lot of people.
Yeah, the sound, I was going to ask you about that. It plays a big part, doesn't it?
Yeah, so after we did that little house and we went to the mansion in the forest, I met and invited Nick Batterham, and he's a musical composer, and he'd worked on a lot of, like, TV commercials and film scores, and I'd never worked with anyone like that before, and I just invited him up to the forest to see this place, and he kind of understood my vision, and he just, like, lost his mind and just went so deep into it.
Brilliant.
He'd never done a project like that either, and able to write a score that not so much is stereo, but, like, I think that one had something like 14 channels, and so you could have the stringed instruments at one end of the hall and the piano at the other, coming from different rooms, but they all kind of work together. And as, you know, people who visited the space, you may remember, you walk into the room with the piano and you could only hear the piano part of the track, and it all of a sudden just became this, it became lonely, and that itself was this kind of powerful kind of moment, and, like, you could hear it calling and not get an answer, and it wasn't until you came back and you could hear the kind of call back and forward from the strings, and just being able to play on that. And this next project's like, all right, well, let's do that, but let's do that even better and again. Brilliant. And build on it.
Now, I know you document it with the fabulous photos, and so therefore, you know, like, that was one of the big things you have always done. But is it hard walking away from it, you know, like, when this exhibition finishes, you know, or you think, nah, I've done it, it's, you know, like, and now it can be all pulled down. What's your thoughts at the end of it?
It's always been like that for me, like, for painting on the street, everything gets destroyed. And, like,
of course.
As soon as I'm finished it, I try and take a photo. Even if it's, like, late in the evening, you try and take a photo because you're scared it may not be there in the morning.
Yeah.
So it does become about the process and the documentation.
Yeah.
Sometimes rather than whatever happens to the final artwork yeah. in the end. And I think that temporary nature of something, again, pushes into that, like the beautifulness of it. Like it has to be cherished mm. because it is temporal.
Yeah. But yeah. I'm finding more and more with a lot of street art these days that it doesn't get touched. You know, like more and more, there's quite a bit around here in St Kilda that the really good stuff, no one does any tagging on it or anything.
That's an illusion. Yeah, it is. I've got works and people are like, oh, they haven't touched that one. I was like, no, it's been destroyed 5 or 6 times, but it's got a graffiti coat on it.
Yeah, right. And you just
Like often now that people are commissioned to paint a mural and then someone will do a graffiti coating over it to protect it so it can last a bit longer.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even know about that. That's like some magic to me.
Another illusion.
Another illusion. Yeah. All right, so it starts this. I hope you're ready. Yeah. You know, like the queues are going to be there.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, like tickets are selling like crazy. And why wouldn't they be? So 28th of October, the 29th of January, a nice long season, but you know, like you're limited with how many people can get in at any given time. So, which is fair enough. And how do you book tickets?
Just go to the website, roan.art.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Cheers.
It's been a pleasure chatting with you and can't wait to see the exhibition.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We've been talking to Rowan here on Joy 94.9 Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au. Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.